So usually I try to put something cool at the beginning, but this time while I was editing it, it just really kept making me mad when, for some reason in this episode, I kept saying Celtic instead of Celtic. Don't know what was up with that. I haven't watched basketball in like 3 years. Sorry about that. Just wanted to apologize now. Thanks.
Another episode of the Talkin' Token Podcast. I'm Patrick Santino.
And I'm Clifford Vickery.
Cool. How you been, Clifford?
Pretty good. Enjoyed the... Actually, am I allowed to give time references?
No, I feel like it's too confusing, but...
Okay.
I mean, no, well, you can just say, like, you flew home and they'll think it's, like, Christmas time.
Okay.
Yeah. And you flew home and what happened? Before you flew home?
I survived two flight cancellations back to back, but I've made it home. In one piece, with no additional delays. How about yourself?
I've been pretty good. I just want to note that we're all blessed by Clifford's delays because he could commit so much more time to doing work.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I got home before this, or I went back before the storm hit, so I'm all good. All right, cool. So, should we get into this?
Yeah. This is episode 9, Barrels Out of Bond.
Yep. All right. So for this episode, we're going to cover kind of just the plot stuff first, or mostly just focus on Bilbo and his rescue here of the dwarves.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll get it back in. We promised last time we would get into the elves, so we'll do a fairly deep dive into where all the mythological references are coming from the elves. Like what Tolkien's basing this off of, like what authentic texts, basically. And then we'll also get into the actual history of the elves within, like, the Middle Earth mythology. Most notably, we'll go over the ancient feud that the elves and dwarves have that always makes them kind of bitter rivals.
Interesting.
Not quite enemies. Yeah.
Okay.
All right, cool. But before we do that, Clifford,
take Cliff's it away. Notes. So, Bilbo and the battle-weary, starving dwarves, having escaped the spiders, get back on their way. They're almost immediately captured by wood elves.
Who I thought that was very convenient, by the way.
Indeed.
That they just got captured, for book purposes.
Before they got lost, I know.
Yeah.
Rather you hear about that. The wood elves take them hostage and lead them back to their lair, where Thorin is being kept unbeknownst to them. Bilbo manages to slip on his ring and avoid capture, and he tails close behind the group and manages to watch his compatriots get locked up in the dungeons and kind of is spying from the back. Bilbo spends weeks roaming invisibly around the palace cave and out into the forest occasionally, stealing food when he can and desperately trying to come up with an escape plan. He eventually jailbreaks all the dwarves, convinces them to stow away in empty barrels in the cellars of the elven fortress, and these barrels get dumped into the river below, being returned to their source, and they float swiftly downstream out of the forest. The barrels and a definitely waterlogged Bilbo, who couldn't manage to get inside a barrel, are all corralled at a midpoint town for the night before being sent further down the river. What'd you think, Patrick?
I thought it was pretty good. Yeah, another good chapter. I thought it was quicker than the last one, because it was.
Yeah, it went by fast.
Yeah, I thought the whole escape thing was pretty fun. Good idea on Bilbo's part.
Did you buy it? Do you think it's a reasonable escape plan?
Yeah, so, you know, but at this point we've beat up the topic of luck so much throughout this series. But Bilbo did pick a very good night to do this.
Certainly.
when all the other elves were gone out to a party out.
Well, he didn't pick the night, right? The night picked itself. He saw that they were getting drunk and he said, this is the time. Right, didn't he?
Yeah, kind of, well, yeah, but I mean, you know, he needed that. He needed the guards getting drunk, but then right. also, like, just the convenience to actually go to all around the palace to get all the all these caves to get all the dwarves, like, that they right. didn't run into anybody in the hallways. It's because they were cleared out, which I guess he could have just been like, hey, this is the time to do it, too, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was a little bit dubious that you could survive freezing rapids on top of a barrel when inevitably you end up rolling to the bottom in that situation. And that the dwarves didn't suffocate, although we don't know whether or not they survived yet. So, some improbability, but I thought it was a lot of fun. This was the most fun escape, I think, that I've read so far.
I thought it was fun, too. I don't know, though, like, that would really suck to be a dwarf. Like, oh, went definitely. In one of the barrels? Oh my gosh. Especially since it's, like, 2 days, you know, in there. It's not a couple of hours. They have to spend the night at least in those barrels.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I like the imagery of it though. So, but on that note, let's expand upon that a little bit. In a similar way to the spiders, where Bilbo's taken the lead and has become like the savior for everyone else, this is another situation where Bilbo literally let everyone out of their jail cells and orchestrated the whole plan and convinced everyone to get in the barrels. He's taken the reins as the team captain, it seems like, without the help of Gandalf, notably, although Bilbo certainly wishes he had a wizard at hand multiple times.
Well, since they're all in jail, obviously Bilbo had to take the lead, unless right. one of them wanted to cave, which it was interesting that... I thought it was interesting that none of them did cave, and, like, spoiling, like, the whole, like, point of their expedition to that.
Yeah, yeah. You know, if all they're admitting was, well, we're going to do this thing far away, it has nothing to do with you, it's not that big of a thing to admit, but everybody...
Well, the elves would have wanted a share of the treasure if they'd let him go.
Which yeah.
The dwarves are pretty greedy and petty, so obviously...
And we heard in a past chapter that the elf king is pretty greedy as well, right?
As far as elves go, yeah.
Right.
I'd say so.
So... Anyways, it seems another place where it was pretty important that Gandalf wasn't there. Bilbo was forced to take the reins in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I remember distinctly noting as I was reading through this that there was like a line that basically said, yeah, directly saying Gandalf left them on purpose so Bilbo could step up like this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like Gandalf said, so basically when he picked Bilbo, he said, yeah, he'll fulfill the role as burglar and he'll do a good job, and then mm-hmm. he left, and that's actually what's happening now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, what do you make of that?
Yeah, it may make sense. He's pushing Bilbo out of the nest.
Right, out of the nest, coming of age kind of thing for Bilbo. Right. Which is what we've been describing the whole time with this hero's journey, but yeah.
Right. It does seem like Gandalf is maybe going beyond the role of hands-off parenting to the point of just being like, we'll see what happens.
Well, in one of the books I was reading, the Bilbo's Journey book, they were saying, you know, you have to kind of let people make mistakes as they grow up. And
absolutely.
Gandalf's letting the dwarves. But yeah, you're right.
I'm saying he's letting them make some pretty life-threatening mistakes. But anyways, I enjoyed the escape. Bilbo remains a pretty primary hero in this whole thing.
Yeah, Bilbo's pretty sweet.
Yeah.
Pretty sweet so far. I like Bilbo at this point.
Do you like him more or less than you did at the beginning?
Oh, definitely more. At the beginning, absolutely. I thought he was a tool.
Yeah.
I thought he was a pansy.
Yeah, fair.
Yeah.
Everyone else did too.
He was like kind of cool with Gollum, but then when he was fighting the spiders, it's like, yeah, Bilbo, you are running stuff now. Like, mm-hmm. let's go. And then this escape is just like, that was well executed. Excellent yeah. job, Bilbo. I'm impressed.
Yeah, he just took everything into his own hands. What did you think about the setting for all this? The castle, or I shouldn't say the castle.
It's caves.
The caves in the woods. Any favorite details you pulled out?
My only favorite details were... what I wrote down was some details about just these elves in general. Uh-huh. I liked the detail that the Elven King wore a crown of berries and red leaves for autumn, but then he changes his crown to some woodland flowers in the spring. I thought that was a cool detail. One of those Tolkien details that Yeah. They're super cool. Super sweet. Mm-hmm. I thought the campfire thing, back in Chapter 8, because we said we wouldn't really cover the elves there, so we're going to, whatever elf parts were in the last chapter, we're going to do it here, too. So those campfires I thought were kind of cool, enchanting and mysterious, how they walk in, and then they just all go out, but then, like, they keep moving around. Alluring, kind of, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was kind of weird that elves would live in caves.
Yeah. Tolkien did seem to make a point, though, that he's, like, distinguishing them from the goblin caves, like,
correct,
these caves are not nearly so bad as the goblin caves, and, you know, they're not as deep or dark or dirty, and the elves don't even spend all their time there. They go out into the woods all the time. It was kind of like a, like he was defending himself or, like, covering his tracks so people wouldn't be like, hey, what about the goblins?
Yeah, and well, what do you think of the setting?
I thought it was pretty cool. I mean, I love the, like, forest mysticism. I would consider myself prone to romanticizing the forest. The drawbridge over the river is pretty sweet. And just the whole kind of fortress built into the hillside, but also over a stream, which they take advantage of at the end, is pretty neat. I thought of this. There's a famous house. I'm an architect, if you remember from the intro. Mm. One of the, probably the most famous house in America is Falling Water by Frank Lloyd Wright, which is a house built on a rocky cliff over a stream in the woods. And some of the imagery reminds me of that. Like, the house literally sits on top of the moving water, which is pretty neat. Anyways.
Where's that house at? Maybe we'll do a tour.
It's in Mill Run, or Bear Run? Mill Run, Pennsylvania.
Hmm. Okay, not sure we'll make it out there soon.
Requires a road trip.
Yeah. All right, cool. All right, so, well, we've already kind of started it, but, yeah, let's do the dive into elves here, the authentic, real mythology references here. Maybe we should, so just, like, some notes here, because Clifford, I think, tried to start to bring this up in Chapter 3 when we were in Rivendell with Elrond's elves, who are kind of considered the high elves or the light elves. And I was wondering, too, I was like, oh, man, Patrick, you screwed up that you didn't talk about this. But then I sat down to actually, like, write up some notes for this, and I was like, oh, man, obviously I avoided this as long as I could. But then, and I also almost thought, like, well, this might get, like, too in-depth, so maybe we should do it in Lord of the Rings or something like that. But we'll start it here. There's no way we're going to, I don't know, we can keep digging deeper into it throughout Lord of the Rings, but this was the time to do it. And I think it's better than Chapter 3, because now we have, like, two kind of differing sets of elves, almost. Because these guys were not, like, the Rivendell ones.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, but anyways, before reading Tolkien or any, like, very modern, very recent fantasy literature, what would you say were the differences between, like, elves or gnomes or fairies? Or any other magical creature that might be somewhat like those.
Well, obviously, I can't divorce my thoughts from, like, pop culture stuff that I've seen, a lot of which is influenced by Tolkien and some others.
Yeah, it's very hard.
But I definitely thought of elves as being sort of human-like, maybe a little bit smaller, kind of tall and thin. Fairies, definitely very small, probably can fly.
What about the fairy godmother in Cinderella, though?
There's sparkle. They sparkle. Okay. Definitely. Tinkerbell, fairy godmother.
Yeah,
there's like a visible magic around them that the elves don't have. And then gnomes are just things in people's garden. Of the earth, small old men, seemingly much more passive than the fairies and elves.
Kind of like Smurfs, too. I thought Smurfs and gnomes, like, might go together.
Gnomes being very stoic. Fairies being very emotional. What about you?
Yeah, well, kind of the same stuff as you. I guess elves, smallish people. If you wanted to get, like, warrior kind of elves, they were, I don't know, maybe my impression was probably based off modern stuff, like, which is also just completely based off Tolkien.
Well, like, what's the video game character?
Right, yeah, that's what I was thinking. Zelda, but it's Link, is the guy.
Yeah, okay.
That's what I would think of as, like, an elf kind of warrior thing. But then there's Santa's elves, who are small.
And then, I've got some interesting thoughts on that in a bit.
Okay. And then there's the Keebler elves that make cookies.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. We kind of touched on those a little bit, I think, in the last one, but, I mean, we didn't do anything else. But, yeah, the fairies, it's like, okay, fairies, yeah, they could be as small as Tinkerbell, but then the fairy godmother, I guess she was a fairy if you think mm-hmm. about it, even though she just kind of seemed like a grandma kind of character. Mm-hmm. But fairies, like, okay, I guess I could believe that they might be bigger than super tiny people, but they're not, like, full human height. But you're right with, like, the sparkling or, like, the translucent.
Yeah, they're sort of ephemeral.
Very bright. And it's super, super light, like, or bright. Bright as opposed
yes,
to light.
Yes, yes. So let's dig into some of the older mythology, kind of the earliest stories that we know about.
Well,
origins.
We're not going to do everything, because, like, there's probably elves and stuff in, like, Celtic stuff and Celtic myths.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably some sort of equivalent in Greek or Roman stuff even. But mm-hmm. just the Norse, because that's kind of, like, Norse is, like, slash German slash Anglo-Saxon. Yeah. Those three all kind of go together.
But also, I think a lot of other mythologies have similar characterizations for, like, sprites, spirits, fairies, that sort of thing. But mm-hmm. elf itself is a Germanic Scandinavian origin that then sort of proliferates in other cultures.
So in the Prose Edda in Norse, there were Duk Elfr.
Mm-hmm.
So those were, like, dark elves who, the details from the Edda and that were, all I could really find were just live underground, blacker than pitch. They almost sounded kind of closer to dwarves. And then there were also light elves, which mm-hmm. they called, how do you pronounce that?
Lus Elfr.
Lus Elfr.
Mm-hmm.
Lus Elfr.
Yeah.
Which were...
Sorry, go ahead.
Which they were just brighter than the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
For those of you who have any Germanic language background, if you can see the word, it's pretty clear. Duk is just looks like a lot like dark, and Alfar is Alf or Elf, and then Lus is the modern word for light in a lot of Germanic languages.
Yeah, but I mean, I think, like, the takeaway too was, okay, there's different kinds of elves, and then mm-hmm. the descriptions of them, some were tall, some were short, some were slim, some were fat, mm-hmm. maybe. So, I mean, there's no, like, real consensus that you get anywhere.
I will throw in right here, so this is the Prose Edda that we're talking about, which, correct me if I'm mixing this up, but that's the later version of the Edda, which the Edda is sort of... It's from Iceland, but it's used as sort of like the Old Testament of Scandinavian mythology, because it assembled a lot of stories from all over Scandinavia into one document, and it's one of the few surviving documents. So the Poetic Edda is the older one.
Yeah.
And then the Prose Edda came around after Christianity had reached Northern Europe. And so... Something researching this a little bit, there's some speculation that this description of the light and dark elves in the Prose Edda was a kind of emerging a combination of pagan mythology, where there were some references to elves as sort of a nebulous magical creature, with Christian mythology, where you have angels and demons, a kind of a light and dark contrast. And the writer of the Prose Edda effectively paganified Christian mythology to merge it into this older version, which I thought was pretty interesting.
So that's kind of going backwards almost.
Yeah, intentionally trying to like rewrite the older myths a little bit. In a sense that the guy who wrote the Prose Edda is studying these old stories, but has been educated in a Christian tradition and is familiar with a lot of these things. So he's kind of treading the line between pre- and post-Christian mythology. And that's another thing, a lot of takeaways from this stuff is, like, almost all these people recording things about elves and writing things down are Christian, like, yeah. Back into the Middle Ages and everything.
So, that was the same with, like, Beowulf, too, when they were doing it
right,
there.
Exactly. So there's a pretty interesting, like, play between the two of, like, pagan myths being recorded, modified, whatever it may be, by Christian scholars.
Yeah, it's extremely confusing to try to decipher, like, the layers of what was original, even. Because, you know, with those manuscripts, we're not even working with the original handwritten things of the original author on those. We're working with copies mm-hmm. and stuff.
So, here's another...
Who knows what's edited, you know?
Some other examples of that, other than the Edda. So in Beowulf, elves are briefly described as one of the races that sprung up from Cain's murder of Abel. And then another Icelandic fairy tale describes elves as the children of Eve, who, when God came to visit her, she didn't want God to see her children, so she hid them, and God proclaimed something in the vein of, "That which you will hide from me, I will hide from you," and they became the hidden people, which is kind of an interchangeable description in a lot of Scandinavian languages, is basically hidden people. So that, I thought that was pretty interesting.
Those are good notes, dude.
Thank you. So moving into, even before we get into Shakespeare, I think even at this time, there's distinct associations of magic, definitely, but also mischievousness. They're associated with causing illness. Elf is thought to be the origin of the word oaf.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so like deformed children or something were often blamed on elves taking the real child or somehow like giving some affliction to humans or like kind of messing with their lives. People described elf curls, like if someone's hair was messed up, it was because an elf had snuck in and messed up your hair. Throughout this time period and into modern times, it was an easy way to explain small occurrences or something like that. Like even birthmarks were known as elf marks in some places.
Not all of these things can be applied to every single elf that they're talking about.
No, definitely.
Every single writing. This is just like a myriad of things.
Right. Basically. These are all kind of general associations. Like we're kind of taking like a mix of these things. The mischievousness is something that comes up a lot.
Yeah. But even that's probably not universal.
No, it's not. Definitely not.
All right. Well, what do we got for Shakespeare? From Shakespeare to Tolkien, let's kind of cover what we got there.
Yeah, so just for context, Shakespeare's writing in the 1500s. A Midsummer Night's Dream is his famous play where elves are mentioned in a vein, kind of like we were talking about fairies earlier. They're very small, diminutive. They have wings. They fly. They hang out around flowers.
But they are talking about elves, or are they talking about fairies?
You know what? I take that back. I think they might have just talked about fairies. Yeah.
Well, anyways, at this point, fairies and elves, there wasn't...
Okay, so Midsummer Night's Dream, he writes about fairies, and they have a fairly... They have a significant role in the story in that they're using their magic to control some of the characters, which plays into... That is sort of an innovation, but it also plays into some of the other thoughts at the time. In addition to this mischievousness, there's lots of times there's like a distinct sexuality associated with elves, sort of in the way that we might associate with mermaids as tempting people.
Yeah.
So... A lot of these elves are typically young, beautiful women who occasionally tempt men into the woods or into certain behavior, or they're old men who do the opposite to young human women. So there's in a lot of these cases, there is a sexual aspect to it. As we move into the Romantic era, Romanticism in the 1800s was sort of a reaction to the Enlightenment, where you've got like an intense imposition of order where they're looking on fairy tales like something bad or kind of old-fashioned. The Romantic era.
And when was that?
The Enlightenment, 1700s-ish.
Yeah.
And then in the 1800s, there's this pushback where in Germany and throughout Europe, Romantic writers and painters and poets are instead pushing back in the other direction where they're looking to fairy tales for inspiration, and they're almost fetishizing folklore, and elves and descriptions of elves see a huge resurgence at this time, as in all sorts of different ways, like spirit of the woods, mischievous characters. There's more depictions of them. In a previous episode, we talked about Earl Koenig as a character that occurs in a famous German painting, and then crops up in a few other places. That's the Elf King, effectively. And like the Grimm brothers, who we've mentioned numerous times and were certainly an inspiration for Tolkien, were sort of part of this revival of the old folklore, and elves were part of that. An interesting aspect that I took away from some of this research is fairy is actually a loan word from French. It has French origins. Mm. And so even though elves and fairies are sort of interchangeable throughout most of this time, there's a push to move, or I would say Tolkien and in a different way, the Grimm brothers embrace elf as a more Germanic version of the same thing. Like we've pointed out in other places how Tolkien, being a professor of Anglo-Saxon literature, was interested in kind of the pre-Norman version of language and culture in England. And the use of elves in place of fairies throughout Lord of the Rings, I think, is part of that, if in, only in a subtle way.
Yeah, but he liked the term fairy. Mm-hmm. I don't want to get into it now because we're already getting pretty deep.
Dragging on too much.
Well, no. I mean, I don't want to get into it now, but because we're dragging pretty deep here. But like, mm-hmm. we will get into this at some point about fairies. And fairy E is kind of just what, okay. That was like his name for this whole magical enchanting elf world kind of thing. But that's really? That's a conversation for another time, really. I think because we got to keep finishing this up with just the current elves that we have here. Yeah, but any other romantic influences?
Not necessarily.
Tolkien himself really liked the Peter Pan play.
Interesting.
He saw that, I think, when he was a teenager. He connected to it because he was an orphan, and Peter Pan basically is like an orphan that never grew up.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so he loved that. And so, I mean...
That's cool. I watched that a whole bunch as a kid.
Yeah, I did,
the movie.
Yeah.
I know it's probably different than the play Tolkien saw.
Yeah, Tolkien did hate Disney. That'll be another conversation for another time, too.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Probably not the place for it here. There's an interesting side angle with elves, modern elves being associated with Christmas. That's been kind of one of the modern reinterpretations that is actually quite recent, where elves are being kind of incorporated into a different connotation. But let's keep going on elves.
Okay. So anyways... What Clifford's kind of saying about that romantic tradition and what we've been saying about just all over the board with like kind of just the whole confusion of this whole fairy elf topic, Tolkien's earliest poems before he even went to war, so he was in college, he started trying to become he started actually working on poetry. So some of his earliest poems, just to name them in case anybody wants to look them up, they're called Woodshine, You and Me in the Cottage of Lost Play, and Goblin Feet, were all written before the war. And they kind of all have to do with kind of like fairies and elves. Mm-hmm. So I'll just read one example. This is... hopefully I get this right. This is part of Goblin Feet from... Yeah, this is part of Goblin Feet. Okay. I must follow in their train down the crooked fairy lane where the coney rabbits long ago have gone and where silverly they sing. In a moving moonlit ring, all a twinkle with the jewels they have on, they are fading round the turn, where the glowworms palely burn, and the echo of their padding feet is dying. Oh, it's knocking at my heart, let me go, oh, let me start, for the little magic hours are all a-flying. Oh, the warmth, oh, the hum, oh, the colors in the dark, oh, the gauzy wings of golden honey flies, oh, the music of their feet, of their dancing goblin feet, oh, the magic, oh, the sorrow when it dies. So he might even, like, be kind of bringing in goblins into like, the confusion of this, too.
Which is not all that weird. If you remember when we were talking about the introduction for goblins, we did a lot of the word origin and the mythical origin around goblins is blurred and mixed with elves and fairies.
Yeah. So one of Tolkien's best friend at the time, his name is Christopher Wiseman. He's actually the only best friend that Tolkien had that survived World War One with him.
Wow.
Yeah. We'll talk in depth about him later. But he said when he read some of these poems, he said, well, he did this in writing, but he's basically like, well, sorry, dude, like, originally, I mistook elves for gnomes with bigger heads than bodies. So, I mean, even Wiseman, his best friend, was kind of confused. Like, what does he mean by elves and fairies and all these things? I mean,
right.
So,
I mean, all this might be part of the reason why, like, through these books, Tolkien had such, eventually, I guess, not initially, but eventually established such a clear definition of, like, what these different characters are and Lord of the Rings being as formative as it was, he kind of set the modern standard for elves versus goblins versus dwarves.
Well, right? Yeah, so now let's actually start to like kind of piece that together. So now now we've laid out all the confusion that we have.
Okay. Let's
kind of put it together as best we can here. So, first of all, within a couple of years of writing those poems, like probably within the 1920s ish, mm-hmm. Tolkien kind of regretted that those poems even exist, cuz that was kind of those were like the small diminutive stature stereotypes in them, and like he didn't like that at all. And obviously he didn't, cuz the elves in these are in all his mythology are pretty
glorified.
I mean they're like a noble race of men, almost like a glorified version of men, really. Mm-hmm. I mean it
wise, calm,
just overall nothing valiant. Nothing like mm-hmm. the little goofy kind of like Tinkerbell fairies, at least.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And so anyways though, but just to touch one last time on the Anglo-Saxon, Norse, German connection here. Those languages all had a word for elf. So like that word, the tradition of elves is immemorially old.
Right.
And like all we said, like what we'd laid out here, all these ideas and concepts of elves, the only thing that Tolkien could clearly connect to every single elf and every single tradition is that elves are just always paradoxical. Just in any way. Like some are good, some are bad, some are light, some are dark, some are tall, some are short. You know, we don't quite know, and it confuses us as we try to like kind of paste together what was the picture of elves from mythology. Like it confuses us, and it probably still confuses everybody. And even kind of what you were saying, like how they're mischievous and everything. I mean, like that kind of even fits with this too.
I thought that the way he characterizes elves, even just so far in The Hobbit, we kind of see that like the paradox of that play out, not in so much as he's talking about two different types of elves, even though we'll talk about the light versus dark elves a little bit, but even in the like Tolkien's upholding elves as this valiant noble race, kind of one of the like the great characters of Middle Earth. Meanwhile, there's like an aura of an enchantment that clearly scares people and puts men at dis-ease, and like Bjorn was like, you know, you got to stay away from the mischievous elves effectively.
Yeah.
They're the ones who are doing the enchanting of the stream. They're part of the reason the forest is dangerous. So you can see the like the contrast even just between the perceptions of elves by Tolkien and elves by these other characters in his story. Or even dwarves who think elves are up to no good all the time. And that could easily parallel what he's seeing in mythology as, like, sometimes they're good and magical, sometimes they're bad and magical. Different things have been attributed to them.
Right. There's just no, like, standard description or picture you can get, though.
Right.
And even of, like, different kinds, you can't say, well, these kinds of... You can't even break down distinctions really well between different groups of them either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But all right, so anyways though, let's just now we'll do the first scene that we saw with these Mirkwood elves in The Hobbit. So the inspiration from that, I guess, so
this is them standing around the fire having their feast.
No, before that.
In the woods.
So Shippey, Tom Shippey, this is where most of the notes are coming from for this section, or from his books. So he says that Tolkien, when he takes like a race of creatures like the elves or dwarves or orcs, he usually has just one little scene kind of in his mind that he like really develops. And so for the elves, the first scene comes from an English work called Sir Orfeo, which there's a hunting scene in that, just like in The Hobbit, how when they're actually crossing the Enchanted River, when Bomber falls in, there's the deer, and then they hear like the horns or the dogs barking, and obviously we can kind of assume that's the elves. So that's kind of where this comes from. So Sir Orfeo, this was Middle English as opposed to Old English, which is like the Anglo-Saxon stuff. So Middle English is kind of like the period after Norman Conquest, before Shakespeare. And then this one in particular is an Anglified myth that's based off a combination of Greek and Celtic myths. So, like, this wasn't originally, like, an English story. It kind of just came to him across kind of just cultures. But anyways, in that scene, King Orfeo is wandering alone and crazy in the wilderness when fairies come riding by on a hunt, and there's a couple verses that I told myself to read. Okay. There often by him would he see, when noon was hot on leaf and tree, the king of fairy, with his rout, came hunting in the woods about, with blowing far, crying dim, and barking hounds that were with him. Yet never a beast they took nor slew, and where they went he never knew. So, that was kind of like the dwarves. They never saw the elves during that hunting scene, if we remember. This is mm-hmm. back in chapter 8. Sorry that we're kind of going backwards, but...
That's mm-hmm. No worries. Yeah.
So, whereas Orfeo couldn't see them because he didn't really know if they were real or not, because they were like the fairies mm-hmm. and like kind of like the fading aspect or like the translucent right. thing that we were saying. The dwarves couldn't see him because they were in Mirkwood, which is a very dark place and, you know, shrouded.
Right.
There's all sorts of just trees in their way, like physical barriers mm-hmm. to seeing them. Mm-hmm. But in both, there's like a sense that there's like there's a world around them that's out of reach.
Right. Right.
Yeah, and then, like, that extends to when later in that chapter they were having the campfires and the dwarves kept interrupting and then they would just vanish right away. That's kind of... Mm-hmm. I feel like that's kind of a classic fairy trait, is to kind of disappear as soon as somebody would intrude, or, like, you just can't catch them or reach them or...
Right. Which parallels Tolkien's description of hobbits as well, like, this sort of... The ability for a creature like this to exist in a modern world,
yeah,
even though they're unknown,
yeah, you know? Yeah, and I think all of this is, I think it's cool that he could do that, and I think he's the most unique person, or he was the best qualified person in all of in his time and currently to ever do this. Like, so let me just read a quote from Shippey here. So he took fragments of ancient literature, expanded on their intensely suggestive hints of further meaning, and made them into coherent and consistent narrative, all things which the old poems had failed or never bothered to do. So, yeah, mm-hmm. he's kind of using small descriptions and all these myths as jumping off points. And from there, he creates a standard for elves. Like, he makes both light and dark elves. Like, elves slash fairies, like, they can kind of disappear when you disturb them, so the campsites go out. Dark elves, they live underground. Well, same here. These elves live underground. You know, we saw uh-huh. the caves in chapter 9. We were in that the whole chapter. And then these uh-huh. light elves are brighter than the sun. Well, Elrond's people, if you listen to all the history parts, they had been to Valinor where there was the light of the two trees which would shine on them and kind of, like, their faces were brighter just if you saw those trees, basically. And that's kind of like, right. So he's making distinctions between the dark and the light elves. But yeah, but like I said, I don't think anybody else was ever more qualified to do that, because nobody knew all the linguistic and just history of all these mythologies as well as him. And on top uh-huh. of that, he's a good, entertaining writer. You know? So right. like, that's like two things going on there.
So to tie it back to the story, I've gotten the gist that we have light and dark elves in The Hobbit, but give me a little more explanation, some background. Is it that the wood elves are dark elves and Elrond's people are light elves?
Yeah, Elrond's people are the light elves. We can call them high elves too. That's more okay. just a uniquely Middle Earth thing. But these wood elves, these Mirkwood elves, the wood elves, they're known as the deep elves. And some of the traits I was writing down at the end of chapter 8, they were saying they distrust strangers. They have strong mm-hmm. magic, but they're more dangerous and less wise than Elrond's people. They love starlight mm-hmm. and living on the edges of the forest in order to escape into the wide plains to hunt. And then they grow weary and kind of gloomy with the coming of men. So mm-hmm. I guess as men become more dominant, they kind of start to, fade away almost. And like, I'm intentionally using the mm-hmm. word fade, but that'll be another conversation again later. But mm-hmm. Tolkien also notes, though, that they're still good people.
So this feels to me like, I mean, it's like a kind of primal characterization, like similar to some of the like hidden people myth, like the idea that they were here first, and as society expands, as men expand, they slowly start to disappear. Not saying necessarily that they're like the native people, but that they're tied to like the old world, effectively.
Yeah, in the history of Middle Earth, elves are older than men. Like right. In the history, when you read the Silmarillion, you'll hear the elves often called the Eldar. And I think you can kind of just use our word elder, because they're the elder race between elves and men. Like, they were born first, basically.
So, in the Silmarillion, how do we distinguish between dark and light elves? Or high and deep elves? Right.
Well, not so much deep elves. Yeah, okay. So we were saying here, any elf that went to Valinor and saw the light of the two trees.
And as a quick refresher for the non-Silmarillians
out
there.
Good idea, good idea.
Valinor is where?
It's across the sea. So if you look, you kind of got to look at a map of Middle Earth. It's extremely west. So if you go west of the map, you'll hit a giant sea. If you go all the way across that sea, there's a sliver of land, and that's where the Valar, who are the equivalent of the gods of Middle Earth, live. And that place is lit up. Before there was a sun and moon, that place was lit up by two trees. One was gold and one was silver. And so the light elves are any of...
So elves were created in Middle Earth, and some of them returned to Valinor with the gods.
Yeah. Well, they didn't return. They went there. But yeah. They were created in Middle Earth. Some of them went there. The ones that went there are called light elves because they ended up seeing the light of the trees. The ones that stayed are called dark elves, and they stayed because like they were kind of suspicious of the Valar who asked them to come, or they just didn't want to, or there was a number of reasons. Okay. But then the ones that go to see the trees are kind of divided into three groups, which they were mentioning still again at the end of chapter 8. They mentioned these light elves, deep elves, and sea elves. Light elves is confusing because like they're all really light elves, but those are just subdivisions of the light elves / high elves, kind of.
Yeah. Okay.
But anyways, we've talked about how some of the elves go to Valinor and then they come back to Middle Earth. And if you remember, they were led by this guy called Fëanor. You remember him? He was the creator of the Silmarils. Remember that?
Okay. And he was the most mad when Morgoth stole his Silmarils.
Yeah. So he led like a third of the elves, and that third of the elves are those deep elves. And now, in the context of The Hobbit, the most direct descendants of those people would be Elrond's people that live in Rivendell.
Okay. Okay. And the sea elves live in the sea?
They live on the shore, yeah.
Okay.
Just one last note. That tribe of elves, that kind of third of elves, they're known as the Noldor. And originally...
The part that Elrond is part of.
And that Fëanor originally led there. Yeah, they're known as the Noldor. Which he developed that word when he was like really setting out this mythology in the 1920s. But originally, the most ancient name that he called them were gnomes. So he was even, you know, back to just that whole fairy elf gnome discussion, like he was even incorporating gnomes into his mythology by considering them just this branch of elves. And his word for in his languages, gnome meant wise or wisdom or crafty. Yeah, kind of cool.
I'd say that's one thing that directly conflicts with my modern interpretation. You know,
maybe, well, that might have been why he originally dropped it, or eventually dropped it.
Yeah, I mean, for me, like, I associate gnomes with dwarves, like, kind of of the earth.
Yeah.
And it feels like, at least this division within the elves, the ones that went back have, like, a heavenly aura to them, right?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, that's what I thought, too, when I was first learning about that. I was like, oh, that's a weird word to pick, dude. Like, what were you doing? But eventually it does kind of just drop the whole concept of part of the elves are gnomes or something. So, and that might be why. That might be why.
Now I know the Elf King in Mirkwood is one of these elves who stayed behind in Middle Earth, and meanwhile Elrond is a descendant of the people who went back to Valinor and then returned to Middle Earth. So they're both elves, but they're kind of part of two different tribes. Yeah. Right. Is there any tension between them, or they get along okay?
That's a extremely mixed bag, but I thought for the rest of the episode we should focus on the elves and dwarves quarreling, because
okay, so for the most part, there might be some complex relations between the light and dark elves, but for the most part, they're on the same
side. Yeah, and by this point in history, all elves are kind of friends with all other elves. You can kind of say that. But throughout, like, the whole Silmarillion or whatnot, some of the elf groups definitely clashed.
there's a little bit more inter-elf politics.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so elves and dwarves. I remember you gave us a little bit of background on this before, or maybe just on dwarves and goblins, but what issue do elves and dwarves have with each other?
At the end of chapter 8, sorry again that we're still on chapter 8, but in addition to all those references about the light and dark elves and the whole descriptions of them, he also started throwing out like all these references to some elf-dwarf feud, and so that comes from what I'm about to read here. In ancient days, they had had wars with some of the dwarves, whom they accused of stealing their treasure. It is only fair to say that the dwarves gave a different account, and said that they only took what was their due, for the elf king had bargained with them to shape his raw gold and silver, and afterwards refused to give them their pay. Skipping in a couple sentences here. All this was well known to every dwarf, though Thorin's family had had nothing to do with the old quarrel I have spoken of.
Okay. So it comes back to treasure, actually.
Yeah. So I guess there's a slight chance that this quarrel might have developed with this elf king, but I'm going to interpret it that they're talking about a far older elf king who is from the Silmarillion.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
So we're gonna buckle up. This is going to be the third time that we dive into the Silmarillion in this show.
Okay. All right.
So these dark elves that never went to Valinor across the
sea.
Right. Okay.
Gotcha.
There's different tribes of them. Just how we said, there's kind of three divisions of the ones that did go.
Okay.
Okay, so there's different divisions of them. And the two branches that we care about, there's some gray elves and some green elves.
Okay.
That's just kind of their names. It's not like...
some earthy colors.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So the gray elves are known as the Sindar. And that just means gray.
Okay.
Okay, but in the elf language.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So now put on your mental, or get out your mental maps. And okay. So if you look at the Hobbit map, we know that Bilbo's house is far to the west of it.
Uh-huh.
If you go west of that, there's a mountain range that runs north to south.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then after that, there's the sea. And that's the giant sea.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the time of the Silmarillion, there was a huge other landmass that was connected on that side of the mountains. Like, a great plains, and then it had, like, a couple mountains and some forests. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Once again, I'll come back to my reference that Patrick disagrees with, where you can think of all of this as North America. That makes Valinor Japan. And at one point, the land bridge in Alaska, the Bering Strait, was connected, and people came over from Asia to Canada. Or Alaska via the land bridge, but it's no longer there. But keep going. Sorry for that confusing interjection.
Okay, I might cut that out. Well, now we're... All right, okay. So now, all right, so you got that whole landmass. So you remember that Morgoth guy who, like, had the fortress of, like, the slag heaps, like the volcano kind of thing in the north?
Right.
So that's...
And he was the one who stole the Silmarils, right?
Right, yeah. So he's in the far north of this map. Of this kind of like subcontinent on the other side of these mountains. All right. Now, in the middle of it, there's this big, huge forest that's probably pretty reminiscent of Mirkwood called Doriath. And so that's where this one king, whose name is King Thingol, king of all the Sindar, because the Sindar lived
all
in this forest.
All the gray elves.
Yeah. So they lived in this forest, and they had his palace was kind of a set of caves. Just like in Mirkwood here, but his caves are called Menegroth.
Okay.
All right. Just imagine the Mirkwood caves that we heard about in this chapter, but then just much grander and more beautiful.
Okay.
Because these guys they lived higher class than the elves of The Hobbit.
Okay.
All right. So, after many other stories, this King Thingol guy ends up getting a Silmaril.
From Morgoth.
Well,
the bad guy.
Well, Morgoth had all three Silmarils. Thingol, somehow one of them gets stolen, and that was like probably the best story of the whole Silmarillion. But that's not the story we're talking about. And anyways, Thingol ends up getting it. So he has it, and now there's a running theme in the Silmarillion that once you get a Silmaril, you're basically going to be cursed and like doomed because, I don't know, it's like the ultimate thing to covet, and then they just are kind of associated with doom.
Okay.
So, anyways, he has a Silmaril, and now he's all about, like, all right, cool, I got this thing, and he's, like, becoming addicted to it, like, loves it, because it's so beautiful to look at. Probably covet.
Yeah.
Covet's probably the best word. He covets it. Yeah. Like, he won't even leave it in, like, a safe. Like, he just has to hold it the whole time or have it on his person at all times. So anyways, from another story too, the mightiest man that ever lived comes and actually brings Thingol a treasure called the Nauglamir, which is the necklace of the dwarves. And this is actually the greatest things that any dwarf has ever produced.
Okay.
And so it's a necklace. And so Thingol gets it as a gift because the dwarves had originally given it to one of Thingol's kinsmen, but that guy's dead now. So now this one man is just bringing it over to Thingol, and Thingol's like, all right, cool. Yeah, I'll take this too. That's sweet.
I've got the best thing the dwarves ever made with one of the best things the elves ever made.
Right, and then he thinks, you know, it would be sweet. What if...
Smash, bang, fusion.
Yeah, what if we could fit the Silmaril into this Nauglamir here, which is the necklace of the dwarves. All
right. Right.
So now, at that point, the mountain range that divides the subcontinent from the one that Bilbo lives on, that runs the north to south mountain range, those are called the Blue Mountains, and dwarves live in them. That's actually where Thorin and all his group set out from when they went to meet Bilbo at Baggins.
Okay.
All right, so anyways, they are just, at this point, they're basically just trade and business partners with the elves. Dwarves and elves don't really love each other, but they have, like, literally a working relationship together.
Right.
So, that they both benefit from. So, they come, there's always dwarves coming, and so Thingol enlists a party of them to basically remake the Nauglamir so that the Silmaril can fit into it.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the dwarves are like, all right, cool, yeah, we can do that. So they're working at it, and Thingol's just, like, sitting over their shoulder watching them do this the whole time. And as he does it, he's just coveting the Silmaril even more. And so are the dwarves that are making this thing, too. So now everybody's just, like, really wants to keep the Silmaril.
Because it wields a power over them.
Yeah, that's just, like, the power of it. And then, it's like the light. It has the light of the two trees. And yeah,
okay.
A big deal. All right, so anyways, though, they're all building this thing. And they're all kind of just getting ideas, like, hey, I want to keep this for myself. And, you know, this is obviously turning into a recipe for disaster. And so then finally it's done. It's the greatest union of the greatest work of the elves and the greatest work of the dwarves. And Thingol wants to put it on. But then the dwarves call him out and say, well, what right do you have to the Nauglamir? We gave it to your kinsmen, not to you. You know, like, this kind of belongs to us. And Thingol's saying, oh, no, they're just doing this as an excuse because they want to get the Silmaril out of me. And so then a quarrel breaks out right there, and it's Thingol versus a bunch of dwarves, and the dwarves end up murdering him.
Okay, so they killed their boss.
Yeah, the elf boss.
Or the guy who hired them.
So they kill Thingol, and then they run away, and most of them get killed, and the Silmaril is recovered, but two of the dwarves get away and run back to the Blue Mountains to their city.
Okay.
Yeah. So... when they get back to their city, and their city's called Nagrod. Nagrod?
Okay.
Yeah. Nagrod. Yeah. In the Blue Mountains. They say that the rest were slaughtered, and so then they start, like, a war. They're saying, like, hey, the dwarves are going to come and destroy Doriath now, because you guys murdered our people, even though they had murdered the elf king that lived in Doriath.
Right.
Which, okay, so yeah. So, anyways, the dwarves come and march in, and they come to Menegroth, which is that cave palace, the Thingol's caved palace.
Yeah. Right, the bigger version of what's in Mirkwood.
Yeah. So they come to that, kill all the elves that are there, and take the Silmaril. And then...
wow.
Yeah, and all the additional treasure that's in the place, too. So now they're in triumph, and they're walking back to the Blue Mountains. And as they're crossing this one river, they're burdened by all the heavy treasure that they have. And so they end up being ambushed by another set of dark elves, who are the green elves, who live they live in, like, another smaller...
so they're cousins of the gray elves.
So they would have definitely would have been, like, they would have had, yeah, relations with the Sindar, the gray elves, yeah.
Okay, so they're on good terms with each other, allies of sorts.
So they come out and ambush them because they heard all about this. They're also with... one of the greatest heroes of the Silmarillion, who we'll talk about it eventually. And then they also are aided by a mysterious force who we'll meet later in Lord of the Rings. And
exciting. Yeah,
and they end up wiping out this group of dwarves completely, and they take back the Silmaril.
So what I'm getting from it is you've got like a triple interception. Like Thingol, this elf king, has this amazing jewel that's one of the most beautiful things in the world. Ask the dwarves to work on it. The relationship goes south. The dwarves try to steal it. The elves steal it back. The dwarves steal it back.
Yeah.
The elves steal it back again. So at the end of the day, you've got like two whole cities, like city states, have killed each other, and the elves still have the Silmaril.
Yeah, and those green elves that ended up at the end getting the Silmaril, and whatever was possibly left of the gray elves, the Sindar, those two peoples kind of merge, and the Mirkwood elves are direct descendants of them. So, like, they were totally had a stake in this. Meanwhile, I said those guys, the dwarves, were living in the Blue Mountains. Thorin's family, as we've talked about in a previous episode, lived in Moria, which was in the Misty Mountains, which we crossed.
Okay, yeah. So his clan wasn't even part of this.
Right, which is what the narrator had said before. So, I mean, it's like, yeah, so Tolkien, when he makes, like, these references in The Hobbit, there's a whole Silmarillion story here about it.
Okay, interesting. Yeah.
So I don't know. I think it's fun to hear the stories, bring them up, and then also just like see all the references that he's having here. And I mean, in this one, I think
absolutely.
I think that story kind of, well, that's like a legit quarrel. You know, like that's like, that is really something to have, like thousands of years of rivalry and dislike between you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And it's, so I think that kind of enriches our knowledge of this elf dwarf feud rivalry thing.
Right. Right. Well, thanks for the in-depth explanation of the Silmarillion, as always.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, and I think we're about at our time. Yeah, I think it'd be good to end it here. All right, now it's today, January 1st. Back in Austin.
Uh-huh.
I'm back in Denver. Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
How's the rest of your time at home, Clifford?
It was good. Are we recording right now?
Yeah, we are.
Okay. The rest of my time was very nice. It was good to see family. I was pretty busy with that. Didn't end up seeing many friends, but did some running and ate some junk food. It's pretty good. What about you?
Yeah, it was pretty good. the rest of the party was fun. Nobody, guess what? Nobody got this question. On the day Patrick, Jack, and Clifford ran from Ignatius to Beverly, which, just for everybody that doesn't know Chicago geography, that's like through the sketchiest neighborhoods of Chicago. It's like 13 miles through the sketchiest neighborhoods of Chicago. Clifford suffered from what? Everybody said diarrhea. That was their guess. But nice. What did you actually suffer from?
Chicken pox.
Do you remember that day?
I do. I do indeed. That was a difficult run.
Yeah. But the end's cool because you get to go out.
Yeah, it's super cool. Yeah. I'm glad we did it.
Cool. So this was, what, we just finished recording the 9th episode. What do you remember that, Clifford? That was like 4 weeks ago.
Help me out a little bit.
It's the barrels one. We talked about elves a lot.
Is it the escape or the arrival in Lake Town?
The escape.
Okay. I like that episode quite a bit.
Yeah.
The setting of the elven fortress in the mountains in the forest is probably one of my favorite settings so far.
Yeah, I just edited that part.
Cool.
Yeah, cool.
And the barrels are probably, I don't know. I enjoy the barrels. I'm a little bit dubious of them, but...
All right, so no... Well, actually, I don't know if there are... I can't find any reviews. I was thinking what we're probably going to start doing, or I'm going to start doing, I don't know if Clifford will, is since we're not getting any reviews to read for our stuff, I'm just going to start reviewing other stuff I like and reading reviews out on here.
Nice.
Just to, you know... soften people up to, like, I don't know, they could...
The kind of things you're after?
Well, to tell them what I'm looking for. I mean, I'll go over the top, because I'm really good at that part.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, you know, that's what they can write about our show, if they'd like. And then they win a prize for it. Whereas I won't win a prize, I'll just expose people to all the stuff that I'm interested in, I guess. So look forward to that next week. Until then, follow us on all the social media. I've been kind of bad with that recently, but I'll try to get back on the horse. Clifford, you still post on Instagram?
I actually did some catching up today.
Nice. Excellent.
So whoever's following might get a surge of posts, but...
Yeah.
I think we're caught up as many illustrations as we have.
Yeah, we got another one coming tomorrow. Sweet. As you listen to this, another one will be out. Okay, yeah. Okay. Anything else for today?
I don't think so.
It's 2019 now, so have a good New Year's, everybody. We'll be
Do you have a resolution you want to share with the audience, Patrick?
Get my back fixed, eat better. What about you?
This might sound like a cop-out answer, but my response yesterday was remain passionate on all fronts. I'm trying not to fall victim to apathy.
That's so Clifford. Oh my gosh. Vague, but yeah, mostly just vague. Okay, cool.
I'm preparing myself for I'm setting myself up for victory here.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's not all right, whatever. We gotta end this episode because this I know this one's already long, and now we just did this a little bit. I might even have to edit this down. All right, anything else though?
I don't think so.
Okay, then I'll see you next week, buddy.
Yes, indeed.
Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Thanks, y'all.